This is a Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on July the 21st, 2000. Our speaker is Shelley Kay of Campbell, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Shelley, and I'm an alcoholic. First thing I'm going to say is you can get coffee anytime you want. You probably would anyway, so I'll feel better if I gave you permission first. My sobriety date is July 27th, 1996. That's me. I'm getting a birthday coming up pretty soon. And that's my belly button birthday, too. I didn't plan that. I'll be 45 on Thursday. I don't have any alcoholism in my family. I'm the only one that I know of, maybe a distant cousin. I had a great childhood. So many of you that I hear share, you know, had really screwed up lives at home. I had a great childhood. My parents are still alive. They've been married 60 years. They never fought. I swear to you, I never heard them yell at each other once. I'm not sure that was a good thing now, because I went out into the world really unprepared, but that's how nice it was at my house. And I had two brothers at that time and a sister, much older than myself, and life was good, really good. I would say that maybe around junior high, I started maybe feeling a little bit like I wasn't quite sure how to fit in anymore. But I dealt with stuff like that in normal ways. I had a horse. I was very fortunate. I would ride my horse. I would write poetry. I would take walks, do art. I never really felt like I had a hole inside of me. And the first drink I took was when I was about 16, and it wasn't my idea. Like I said, I rode horses, and there was these girls that I rode with. They lived in the really rich part of town, and they were about the same age as I was, and maybe even younger, but a lot more worldly. And I guess they thought it would be funny, I don't know, to see Miss Goody Two Shoes Shelley get all screwed up. So they invited me out to their house that night to spend the night. And the first thing they did was they offered me these brownies to eat, but they took them off the top shelf of their bedroom, you know, like way up high. And I wasn't that stupid, so I said, you know, I don't know, I'm no thanks. But somehow they managed to spike everything I drank and ate. I don't know. I had no clue what was happening to me, and until we were playing Monopoly and I started like sinking lower and lower on the floor, and I was going at the pieces, and it scared me at first. I was feeling really strange, and then it just took over. And I remember I had a blast. I remember that they were laughing at me, but I didn't really care. And you know, I woke up the next morning and I felt really hurt and really betrayed. And I didn't feel any too good either. And I went home. But I never forgot the way I felt when I was drunk. And I would say that that I never knew there were any holes or anything missing inside of me until I felt what it felt like to have them filled up for the first time. And to feel like at ease, truly at ease, and to not care what other people thought. And so I put that away in the back of my mind. Now let's go fast forward. That was when I was about 16. Maybe when I was close to 30. I know I was an alcoholic at that time. I'm not a person that swore I wasn't an alcoholic. I will tell you now, I did not know what that meant. I thought an alcoholic was a person who drank too much and should stop. But I knew that my drinking wasn't normal. I always hid my drinking, always, because like I said, my parents hardly drank. They were very vocal about people who drank too much. I knew I was going to be judged. So I was never a person that was out there in front of them drinking, having them get mad at me, making a fool in front of people because I kept it to myself. So anyway, when I was about 30, I remember sitting on the steps of my apartment. I lived alone, and on a nightly basis, I would be driven to go get that half pint. Now, that makes me laugh now, a half pint. Shit, if I could drink only a half pint a day, I'd probably still drink. But at that point, that's what it was, and I would be compelled. I'd sit on the step, and I'd go, okay, I'm not going to drink tonight. But I could not get that obsession out of my mind. It would be going, but you really want to drink, and what if you did drink, and how would it feel if you did drink, and do you think you will drink? And no, I'm not going to drink. And what that would be like, oh, that'll be awful. Well, I'm not going to drink, and I'd always end up at the liquor store, always. And even from that half pint, I remember I'd wake up the next morning and I did not feel good. Well, let's fast forward some more years. I got pregnant in 1986, and I had my daughter. I was a single mom at that time. I was pretty good about not drinking while I was pregnant. I was really sick with morning sickness, and it was pretty easy for a while, although I did occasionally drink when I was pregnant. It scared the hell out of myself. I was absolutely convinced I was going to have an abnormal baby, but I couldn't stop doing it every once in a while. I just knew that when I had her, or it, I didn't know what it was going to be at the time, when I had the baby, I was going to be able to stop drinking. No problem. How can anybody be a single mom, have a baby, you know you got to get up all hours of the night? You can't do that drunk. Yeah, you can. I'm sure that there's other women here that know that you can. You can be a drunken mother. Within 2 weeks after her birth, some friends were visiting, and my parents were there too. And everybody was getting ready to leave. I couldn't drive it because I'd had a C-section, and I sent my friends to the liquor store to get me a quart of Jack Daniels. And so I'm sure, and I was breastfeeding, so I'm sure that's what she was drinking for a good portion of her early months. And I would do things like I would finally get her to sleep and just need to go to the liquor store. And I didn't want to wake her up, so I'd leave her in the crib, get in my car and drive to the liquor store. The whole time thinking, what if people knew I was doing this? What if something happened? But it didn't stop me from doing it. That's what I did. I proceeded to get married and have two more babies. In about 1992, the way I was drinking was that one afternoon, I was well into my pint of vodka, and my husband was pretty much down to a 12-pack of beer, I think, by maybe noon. He was a violent man. He got mad about something. I had my very young son in my arms, and he was getting in my face in the bathroom, and I was trying to get out past the door, and he shoved me, and my poor son's head flew and hit the door jamb, and it made me angry. And so I pushed him back. And he grabbed me by the throat. I don't even know to this day what happened to baby. I guess he fell on the floor. He grabbed me by the throat, threw me onto the bed, strangled me until the blood vessels in my eyes were like bruised. I mean, I had bruises up here just from the pressure. I swear to God, I thought I was going to die. Threw me on the floor, proceeded to walk back and forth over at me, yelling me. I was afraid to move, till he finally went in the bedroom and passed out. Now, I did not call the police, and I did not leave when he passed out. I went to the liquor store. So that's how I drank. I knew even then that my predicament with him was my fault. Not to not blame him. I have no love for that man and no forgiveness, frankly, but I knew I got myself there. And I figured I was doomed. I remember I used to question myself. Is it really him that's the problem? Or is it me? Maybe the fact that I get drunk all the time is making a difference here. And the only way I'm ever going to know the truth to that answer is to stop drinking. But I can't stop drinking, so how am I going to find out the answer? And it just went on, and it went on. July 26, 1996. I got transported from Salinas to O'Connor Hospital in San Jose. I had a 0.32 blood alcohol level about an hour after I quit drinking. They poured me unceremoniously into a bed on the fifth floor. I don't think they were happy with me. I'm told I was swearing up a storm at the admitting nurse. I don't remember any of it. And so that's where I woke up on my birthday. I had not been intending to get sober on my birthday. I had started, I had been on 26-day run, drunk every day. I'd been going to work. I had just gotten out of a recovery center in May of 96. I had gone to the camp. On July 1st of 1996, I had 60 days sober. I went to a meeting at 11 o'clock, got my 60-day chip, proceeded to move out from that violent husband finally and get my own apartment. And by 6 o'clock, I was at the liquor store, and I was drunk. And I hear people tell us, you know, they say up here that they got struck drunk. I don't believe it. I remember that day. I was thinking about drinking from the minute I got my chip, and I kept sort of saying, I won't do that. I never called anybody. I never asked for help. I never reached out, called the camp, did anything that they teach us to do here. I even, when I was buying the, going to buy the liquor, I was in a supermarket in Salinas, thinking, and I was shopping too, I was getting stuff from my apartment, I was thinking, maybe I'll run into somebody from the group that I go to, they'll stop me, and it'll be God's will, and I'll be okay. And do you know that somebody was in there from the fellowship and came up and spoke to me, and I remember in my head I'm talking to him, but I'm thinking, thank God I don't have the vodka in the cart yet. And so I bought my groceries, and then I went to a liquor store because I was pretty sure I wouldn't see any of you over there. And I took it home and I got drunk. And 26 days later, here I am in San Jose. I woke up on my 41st birthday. I don't remember a lot about that day. They pretty much left me there. They didn't give me any detox drugs because I'd been so drunk. And I just remember kicking and moaning because it hurt really, really bad. And the next day was a little bit better. And I began to say to myself, oh my God, what have you gotten yourself into? You drank so much finally that you're in a hospital detox and you can't get out. I can't have a drink today. And I began to think, how could I get a drink that day? Well, when my husband is the one that brought me up, he was very pissed. He had taken my purse, my credit card, all my clothes, everything. So all I was like in hospital pajamas, and I was thinking, okay, I could just walk out of the hospital. I'm sure that, you know, you can probably get out of here. It's not like a jail. Well, then what are you going to do? Well, where am I going to get clothes? Well, my credit card. No, I don't have a credit card. You know what? For the first time in my life, it got too hard get a drink. I could not bear the thought of, escaping out of a hospital in the hospital pajamas and trying to find a drink on the street. This is not Shelley. This is not where she came from. Other people can do that. God bless you. I couldn't go, and it was so, and I said, oh my God, I think I had better want to get sober. It occurred to me also that if I had managed to get out of there and get a drink, I was going to be back. And it probably wasn't going to be to that nice hospital. O'Connor's pretty nice hospital. It probably wasn't going to be there, you know, getting picked up in your hospital pajamas. They might take me to a psych ward or something. And not that I never belonged there, but I'd never been there. And then I'd have to fight the battle that day. If I got a drink today, I was going to have to fight the battle tomorrow. So if I'm going to fight the battle, why don't I just fucking give up now? Let's get on with this deal and fight the battle. And that's probably the beginning of a spiritual awakening for me, was to make a decision to find a desire in myself. I don't know about you. I'm not good at doing things I don't want to do. It's just too hard. So I began to awaken. At that time, they've closed it down since then, but O'Connor had a program. And I was an inpatient for about 4 days, and I started going to the classes and all the activities that they tell you to do. I want you to know that was the best life I had had in so long. I'm very, very blessed in my sobriety. My life with that man and where I had gotten myself with my drinking, the violence, my life was so unmanageable by me. That hospital stay and just the people that were there that were like me and were also starting to come alive and laughing a little and visiting, and they were smoking cigarettes. That was the best life I'd had in a long time. I was happy. I didn't know it. I'm sure he's always been working in my life. I can see from here how he had started to work in my life at that time. The counselors tried to get my husband to come and participate in the family program. He refused. Thank you, God. We thought what a jerk he was. It's all turned out to be just as well. In the end, what happened actually is that he, like I said, he was very angry. He pretty much dumped me there. He left me with, kept the kids. I had my 3 kids. He kept the kids, and he was mad, and I was on my own. At about 4 or 5 days of sobriety, they actually told me, you need to find a place to live up here if you're going to stay in this program. And I said, what? You mean you're not going to let me stay in the hospital? But I'm from out of town. I'm different. I must be different. I'm from. What do you mean? I was crying. Well, I carried around a box of Kleenex for 2 weeks straight. I just took it with me everywhere because I was always crying. And no, we recommend you live in a sober living environment. By the way, for women only. That was not the first time I've been married. I kind of have a history with men, so they didn't want me around men. I was amazed by that. I couldn't believe it. But anyway, I couldn't even believe the idea of a sober living environment, a recovery house. Not that I'd ever seen one, but I couldn't imagine. I said, well, I'll go look. All the time I'm thinking, there's no way I'm doing this. The guy took me to an all-women's recovery house, one or two, to show me what they were like. I was crying then again. I said, he gave me a hug. I said, I can't do this. I can't do this. It's all right. It's all right. Thank God. I had no other choices. I went back to the hospital. I'm thinking about it. Where am I going to go? I can't get an apartment. I don't have any money. Nothing. What am I going to do? I had to call my parents and tell them one more time I'm drunk and in a hospital and I need $600. I'm very blessed. My parents gave me the money. I ended up saying, okay, I'm doing what you're... okay, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I'm going to the recovery home. Are you sure I can't live in a co-ed one? No, not if you want to stay in this program. Okay. And I will never forget that day because I wasn't used to San Jose, and it was hot, hot, hot. And it was a two-story house very close to, in this area, off of Hamilton. And the bedroom was upstairs, and the sunlight was streaming in, and the walls were kind of bare, and there's 2 single beds in there. You remember, I'm 41 years old. I've been living on my own a long time. I'm just not impressed. And, what have I got on? I've got on a pair of men's shorts that somebody gave me in the program with a tie He gave me a men's tie. That's around my waist. And I am not impressed. Anyway, I stood there and I go, and I remember thinking, I don't know how to do this. I don't know what I'm supposed to do next if I don't get to have a drink first. What do I do? And the answer came to me not because God spoke directly to me or because I'm so intuitive, but I had been to meetings before, and so I had heard somebody say, you do what's in front of you. So I unpacked. And it kind of went from there. So I'm going to this recovery program. Here I am at this house. I don't have a car. I don't have any transportation. I never got my driver's license taken away, but my husband won't give me my car. So I have to get a ride back to the recovery center the first couple of days. And then he, out of the good graciousness of his heart, he drives up my bicycle for me. So I've got a bicycle over here, and I'm riding over to O'Connor. And the most amazing thing happened to me, and this is probably the next part of my spiritual awakening, because I'm at a point now where I'm deciding, okay, I want to get sober. I don't know how the hell I'm going to do this. I can't imagine what it's like, but I want to. I ride my bike over to the recovery center, and we're reading the doctor's opinion. I have read the big book before. I have read the first 164 pages more than once. But for some reason, what I'm about to say next didn't click with me. I'm sitting and I'm kind of, you know, the way we are when we're new, we can't really think too straight about anything. And all of a sudden I hear that I suffer from a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. And that if after any period of sobriety, I take a drink, I will once again start up that phenomenon of craving and obsession, and I will not stop. This is a fact. This is not a theory. They tell us here the spiritual life is not a theory. Neither is alcoholism. It's a fact. If you're sober and you're shaky and you think it's going to get better if you drink, it's not. You're going to get stuck in that place and have to fight that battle I decided I wasn't going to fight anymore. And that made a huge difference to me. It's pointless. I really got to stick with this thing where I want to get sober, because drinking is pointless for me. I got a sponsor. I'm really surprised by that still to this day, because I had been in these other recovery programs. They tell you to do the same thing. I never managed to really do it. But I came to a meeting at Saturday Night Live. By the way, the reason Saturday Night Live is my home group, the reason I came to Saturday Night Live is because it was the only place close enough to walk from the recovery home. And when I walked in, I really liked it. I've been coming here ever since. I totally forgot what I was going to say next. Damn, I hate that when that happens. Oh, I got a sponsor. Thank you. I was at a meeting here. It was in a different room, and there was this really great lady speaking. And this is so funny. I actually went up and asked her. She spoke, and then her boyfriend spoke, and I thought he would be a great sponsor for a guy back at the recovery center. So I went and asked him if he thought he could sponsor this friend of mine. And he gave me that number, but he said, while you're here, why don't you talk to my friend? And she was a woman. And she said she would sponsor me. So that's how I got my first sponsor. And she started me working on steps, but she didn't seem to have a lot of time. I'd call, and she was a very popular sponsor, so she was busy. And, you know, it's very odd to me, but I wasn't satisfied with that. Now, I normally would like that. I'm the kind of person, great, if I can skate by, all the better. Thank God if your sponsor's not home. Who wants to talk to that person anyway? But it was bugging me. I'm thinking, I got to do this thing this time. I got to do it right. I'm coming to these meetings. These people, I believe them. They're really sober. They say they're working steps. I got to do this thing. So I was attending another group also at 6:30 in the morning, which is down the street on Saratoga, and there was a woman there who seemed like she probably wouldn't take any shit from anybody. She'd had some really awful experiences in sobriety. I mean, her fifth step was probably really... She had done a lot worse things than I've ever done. That's what I'm trying to say. I knew I could trust her. I knew I could easily share with her. I picked her for my sponsor. I began working steps. By the way, I should say also, in the meantime, I'm going to... I didn't have to work. I was on disability for the first 3 months, I guess. I was going to like 3-4 meetings a day. I was doing the program all day at the hospital. I was, you have to go to a house meeting at night because I'm living in the recovery center. So I'm doing the deal. I really, my God. Or is every one of you here court committed? Or having to sign a slip for your house? I've never seen so many. But God bless you. I mean, I had to do the same thing. I was coming here. I was getting my thing signed. Anyway, so I get the sponsor, I'm working steps, I'm going to all these meetings. Now, I've been reading the big book, and I understand that there's, you know, they tell you kind of in the big book and in the 12 and 12 how the steps go. Well, so I get this sponsor, and I'm really tickled. She tells me, I don't do the steps the way they are in the book. And I was kind of disappointed. But I'd also been around just long enough to see other people switching sponsors all the time. I'd already done it once. I said, screw it. I don't care. Whatever you say, I'm going to do. Okay, so first step. She had me do the same kind of a first step that if any of you, and I'm sure many of you, have been in recovery centers, it's the same kind of a thing. You got to write down the kind of things you did when you were drunk that you wouldn't have done otherwise. How much money did you spend on alcohol, including insurance, hospital stays, missed time at work, et cetera, and all these reasons that are supposed to prove to you why you are powerless over alcohol. So that's what I did for my first step, but like I told you, I got the first step, I believe, when I was in the hospital and heard the doctor's opinion. I am not powerless over alcohol because I spend a lot of money when I'm drunk. I'm not powerless over alcohol because I do crazy things. I'm powerless over alcohol because I have a disease that makes me powerless. But I didn't tell her that. I just did what she said. So we move on to step two. Now, this was a really good one. She tells me that she wants me to, I have to pick two things that I want to change in my life. And I'm going to spend a month working on this working on it. So, am I stupid? I'm an alcoholic, but I am not stupid. The second step says, came to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. You're supposed to fail this thing. You're supposed to, if she tells me to pick two things and spend the month showing that I can do them, I'm supposed to fail because I'm supposed to get the point that I can't do it on my own. Well, perfect, I've got this one down. So I chose, I was going to stop credit card spending and I was going to stay out of relationships. She said, pick a start date, tell me when you're starting. One day I went to Valley Fair. I spent $600 on clothes on my credit card, and I started the next day. During the course of that month when I'm supposed to be staying out of relationships, I reunited with my ex-husband, that violent, crazy, insane person. She was so pissed off. Oh, she was mad. She threatened to fail me on the step. She said she told me some reason, I honestly can't remember. She said, the only reason I'm not failing you is something. But the truth of the matter is that by that time, in my heart, I believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I was certainly not perfect, and I was not always entirely willing to be restored to sanity or desirous. But one day I was riding my bike to a meeting and I'm thinking about this story of mine. I'm thinking about that last day when I got carted off to the hospital. And, I mean, there had been police at my apartment that day because somebody phoned in on me. I was drinking myself to death. And my boss had come and told me I needed help. And it was a messy, messy, awful, embarrassing day. And I'm thinking about that. And why did it have to be that way? And why did my husband dump me here? And why won't he come see me? And why? And it occurs to me, those words that I heard in meetings. Because God will do for you, Shelley, what you cannot do for yourself. And how else would you have gotten here and stayed here even as long as you have? If Jeff had been nice to me when he brought me to the hospital, I'd have probably gone home 5 days later. It made it very apparent to me. And I knew that there had to be some kind of higher power, that if you could step back and let that power guide you, you're going to do better. So we move on to the third step. She told me to buy a picture of what I would like to envision my higher power as. I'm supposed to go out and get a big picture so I can put it up in my room and I can talk to it, so I can get used to talking to God. I'm already praying. So I went and I got this picture of a tiger, put it over my TV. I couldn't do that. I mean, it wasn't working for me, you know. She'd ask me how I was doing with my picture. Fine. Tiger's fine. And in the meantime, step three was maybe a little difficult for me, only because I didn't really get it, and I'm getting kind of crazy direction here. I'm doing my best to follow direction, but my direction was a little crazy, and I'm busy trying to figure. Now, see, I'm living back with the ex-husband in Salinas, and I've gotten a job by now, so I'm commuting from Salinas to San Jose to work every day and to that 6:30 meeting, because I was pretty crazy to go back, but I wasn't absolutely insane to the fact that I would leave behind sobriety in San Jose and a job that I had gotten that was good. So I was commuting every day, and I'm trying to figure out what God's will is. I'm missing the point. Step three is a decision. You just make a decision. But I'm missing that point. I'm thinking, what is God's will? So I got a little slowed down and a little lost on that one. The tiger never offered me a bit of advice. Very disappointing. What has come to me over a period of almost 4 years now is that God's will for me, anyway, is not something out there. It's not something I have to search for. It's what's in front of me. It's doing what's in front of me to the best of my ability every day. And therefore, my prayer to God every morning is, please, whatever it is I can do for you today, put it right in front of me. Because if it's not, I might miss it. And I swear to you, I will do what's in front of me today just to show you how grateful I am for everything you've already given me. That's my prayer. So that's my belief on God's will for me. In the beginning, I thought, simple stuff. I really, if you're having trouble with that and you're new, God wants you to eat. He doesn't want you to starve yourself, because it feels much better to drink on an empty stomach. He wants you to eat. He wants you to sleep. He wants you to go to meetings. He wants you to be sober. He just wants you to do those things that are in front of you and learn to care about yourself like a human being that is loved by God. It's not some missionary Maharishi thing like I thought it was. On God's will. What is God's will? Just going to work for me, taking care of my kids, coming to meetings. So we finally got to step four. So easy in the book. It's just a grid, goes across. She told me to write a detailed story of every significant person in my life and my relationship with them. Months later, I'm still writing. She said, well, maybe you shouldn't be so detailed. Thanks for telling me. I probably wrote about 90 pages. The longest part was on my mom. And you know, God bless her, this woman that helped me. I stayed sober. I'm still sober. Sometimes it isn't the direction that you take so much as it is that you finally take direction. She didn't tell me to do anything that actually harmed me. That was a long fourth step. It was only difficult for me in the sense that because I was getting in such detail, it was long and involved. And sometimes I lived those feelings again. I found myself feeling odd at times, just odd. Why do I feel odd? I haven't felt this kind of weird since I was like 17. Oh, well, that may be because that's about where I'm at right now when I'm writing. 17 and how I felt then and how I was beginning to feel that kind of out of place stuff. Okay. I shared my fifth step with her at her house. Took me 7 hours. My relief, many people speak of a profound relief when they're done with their fifth step. Mine came from the fact it was over. I was not scared to share those things. Like I said, I had already picked somebody that I knew wasn't going to find anything that I had to say worse than what she had done herself. But I really wasn't scared. I mean, you can tell that by doing the steps these way, it took me some time. I was coming around here a lot. Not like some people who really get, you know, put through the steps right away, as you probably should. But I was hearing a lot of stuff, and I was hearing all of you share. You were just like me. You did things worse than me, the same as me, not as bad as me. So I wasn't scared of anything that I've ever done. I was scared, however, of acting that way again, of feeling that way again, actually. The things I did, this is a nice accompaniment, the things I did, I might dance soon, the things I did were never really that out there and horrible as compared to the way I felt. I felt sickening all the time. Sick and sickening, and I didn't want to feel that way again. So if doing a fourth and a fifth is what it takes to assure me that I don't have to go back to that, it's a piece of cake. Things start to get sketchy around step six. I mean, I was doing what she told me at that point, definitely. I mean, I'm making a list of my character. Now, wait, I got to go back here. I have this immense fourth step. Shared in my fifth step. I'm thinking, she tells me I can burn it. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to go someplace really cool and I'm going to burn this thing. It's going to be a ceremony. I never get it. It sits in my closet for a year. I finally move. I dump it unceremoniously in the trash. 2 days later, I come to a meeting and hear Bob Knight, my husband, not then, share, you don't burn or throw away your fourth step. It's your roadmap to all the other steps. Oh, my God, I just threw it in the trash. So I had to make a list for the sixth step, and she had me do it some longer way. I'm not entirely sure what it was. I don't remember right now, but I did it. And
just love it.
And then get to step seven and humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. That's an interesting step. I really think that for me to get the full meaning for me out of the seventh step came from being able to read and recite the seven-step prayer. I am now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defective character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. I don't get to choose what goes away today. It never worked anyway. I would try to eat less. It wouldn't work. I would pick anything and try to work on it, and I never could seem to stick to it except for the sobriety deal. And yet, one day, maybe a year and a half later, both my boss and my current sponsor told me, "You have an amazing way of sharing the truth about yourself." Wow, I had become more honest. I hadn't been working on that one. Other than the fact that I made a commitment not to steal from Payless when I got sober, or anywhere else, but I mean, I used to have a problem with Payless for some reason. So here I was getting honest, and I was like doing other things, but he's somehow making me a more honest person. And so, like so many of the other steps, it wasn't actually the when I was doing the steps that I got the step. It was seeing how they were affecting my life. That I was changing, but it generally wasn't the things I was trying to change. She had me make a list of the people that I had harmed. It was a lot more detailed than that. But I made my 8-step list. And we go on to step 9. Now, I've had some interesting experiences with that step. I had this one amends that I wanted to make to my sister. And my sister lives back in Missouri. And so it was my decision to write her a letter and to tell her that when I had been staying in her home, I guess it had been maybe 10 years earlier, it was me that drank the liquor out of her liquor bottles and watered them down, not her teenage daughter. It was me who had taken the ring. I had traded rings with her at one point, and I didn't like the trade. It was a crappy trade. I got the worst of it, and I'd always wanted that ring back, and so one time I just took it. It was mine, right? Well, she thought her teenage daughter's boyfriend did it or something, and I never set things straight. So I decided to write her this letter. And I checked this with my sponsor, worded it carefully. I wanted her to be aware of these things and that I felt very badly. And if there was any way I could make it up to her, what could I do to make it right to let me know? So I sent it. About a week and a half later, I get this call. Not from my sister, of course, because in our family we didn't communicate too well. From my mother. Because my sister, who is... I'm going to be 45. She's close to 60. She's a lot older than me. My mom's 85. Who has called my mother to tell her that she can't believe that I told her those things. Tell her never to tell me anything like that again. I don't want to know. She's crying. She was furious with me. So my mom calls me, but not before she goes to her hairdresser, who has been in the program for 17 years, and tells him the story. And then, of course, he tells her that, well, you know, you're really not supposed to make those amends if it's going to harm somebody. And so she calls and tells me that, and I said, oh, my God, Mom, but I checked with my sponsor, and I really felt I was doing the right thing, and oh, my God, what a mess. I had to make an amends for the amends. We talk again. My mother's kind of a funny story, though. I have to just say this quickly. Early on in sobriety, I read a book. It was called Drinking a Love Story. Drinking a Love Story. Not Drinking a Love Story. I enjoyed it. It was an interesting book. Well, one more time, my mom read it. My mom told my sister that she was going to tell me about it. No, I think it was the other way around. My sister told my mom that she was going to tell me about it. My mom said, oh, I don't know. You know, she might not be able to take reading that stuff. So she tells me about it finally, and I said, I've already read it. It's great. Enjoyed it. No problem. She told me, yes, I read it too. It was great. Just like going to an Al-Anon meeting. Now, my mother has never been to an Al-Anon meeting. We recommended that my parents go. She wouldn't go, but she knew that this book, reading a book, is just like being in Al-Anon. At that point, after I got pretty well on my way on my amends and had kind of done the ones that were available to me to do at that point, and She pretty much left me with 10, 11, and 12. She had me do the reading. We discussed, what it is. She considered it maintenance steps. And she left me with that. Now, I will tell you that I kept her for a good long time, about 2 years. It was good for me to take direction, and it was good for me to do things I didn't want to do. But I still had a hunger to work the steps as they were in the book. She also had this thing about liking to actually advise me in my relationships, advise me in my life. I don't like that. I don't believe that's a sponsor's job, especially when they tell you you can't do what you want to do, but that's beside the point. I really don't think that's their job. I believe a sponsor's job is to help you through the steps, to guide you through the steps. I couldn't take it anymore, and so I did call her one day, and I asked her, I told her I was feeling less comfortable, I wasn't seeing her as much because she had moved further away, and I was going to ask somebody else to be my sponsor. And she was not happy, but she was not unhappy. I mean, she was okay. She respected me for asking her that, and so then I called my current sponsor and asked her. And I really appreciate it. I was going through something at that time, and I really appreciated the advice she gave me. See, my first sponsor was always giving me human advice. You know, if you're having a problem with this relationship, then you should get out of the relationship, or you should behave this way to get this reaction. And what my new sponsor told me when I was going through this thing, and I just couldn't come up with an answer, and she said, Shelley, surrender. Those are the kind of answers I need today. And that's what I did. I surrendered and said, I don't know. And whatever it was that it was at the time got better. So that kind of leaves me here, basically. I got that sponsor. Well, I guess it doesn't really leave me here. I got that sponsor about a year and a half ago. Probably a good thing I got a new sponsor. After that, I'll just kind of update you before I finish the meeting. I'll kind of update you on where life has taken me. You know, that whole time when I was newly sober and I didn't have my kids, I want to share something with you in case if there's women here or even men that have the same feeling, if you're new. I felt guilty that I was living in a recovery home, learning to be sober, enjoying my life, frankly, and my kids were not with me. I did not feel guilty because I really wanted to be with my kids and I felt so terrible I couldn't. I felt guilty because I really liked what I was doing. I believe my kids were happy at that time. They had told me they were happy there, that although he had been a horrible husband to me, he was a good father to them, and they were happy. And I thank God for that time. Because I did. I had a cool life. One of my favorite things about early sobriety was I had one key. I had a bike key to my bike lock. You know, in the recovery houses, they give you the lock, the combo things that are like outside the door so they don't have to change the key every time one of us leaves. So I didn't have a key to the house, and I had a key to my bike lock, and that was so bitchin'. Now I have many keys because I'm responsible again. But thank God I had those 2 years because suddenly, I have to go back to step two. I told you that I tried to cut my credit card spending. I was supposed to be trying to cut my credit card spending, and I was not supposed to get in a relationship. And yet I went out and I spent all this money on a credit card, and I got back together with my husband. What I had wanted to tell you was that in reality, it is the higher power that, you know, can restore us, and he set me straight because I had to declare bankruptcy. No more credit cards for Shelley. Shelley doesn't have a good credit rating. Shelley has no credit cards. And the ex-husband, even if I had been considering having a friendly relationship for the sake of my children, he committed a heinous crime against the oldest one and went to prison for 12 years. So God has his justice. And I got my children back. It was it, it proved that, unfortunately, that he wasn't the father that they had thought he would be, and that frankly I hoped he would be. I hoped he was. I was liking my life. Here it was kind of a shock to get my kids ripped away from me, and then I began to kind of like my life and seeing them every other weekend on visitation. And then this horrible, horrible thing happened. But I'm sober. And when it happened, and I found out about it suddenly one Monday morning, I did not think to take a drink. I asked God, I said, whatever it is that I got to do to get this taken care of, give me the power to do it, please. And I have ever since then. It's been amazing. If you come around here, you'll see me with my kids. My kids come to meetings sometimes. It's gone really well. There were a few times in the beginning after I got them back that I swear to you, I said, if this is all there is to life, I'm fucked. I had it good and now I've got these kids and it's so hard. How do people do it? I have found that my character defects come into play when I try to deal directly with a feeling that is troubling me. When I think the solution is to fix my feeling, some character defect comes up. But when I just deal with the truth that's in front of me, which is I have the kids and I better take care of them, and if I just keep on doing it, my feelings changed. I'm really happy I have my kids today. They're pretty darn funny. They're irritating as hell and very amusing. And then somebody even wanted to marry me after that. I mean, when Bob married me, my God, you know, he not only got a handful of me, but he got three kids in the bargain. That takes a lot of courage, Bob. So I have a very good life today. It's a busy life. There's not enough time. But it's a very good life. It's a good life, I believe, because, like I told you before, I just ask God every day. There is not a day that goes by. I pray every day. I may forget in the morning sometimes on the weekend, but I pray every day. Well, I'm having fun. I pray every day, usually twice a day. I thank him every time for my sobriety. I have felt really shitty in sobriety at times, but I have never felt shitty about sobriety. I have felt sick, with fear maybe, sick, mentally ill. And I have said to myself, thank God I am sober, because can you imagine how screwed up I'd be if I was drunk on top of it? There's got to be people new here. I know a few of you introduced yourself. Welcome to you. If you're scared, everybody is. There's so much to learn and so much to hear, and you just got to keep coming back because you learn a different lesson every day, and as soon as you think you've got it, a week later you know you don't, and the answer is something else. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful life. And if you're female and I can ever be of any help to you, you can see me around here. I'm here almost every Monday, Tuesday, and either Thursday or Friday at 6. And just introduce yourself to me, and I'll offer you some help. God bless you all, and thanks a lot.